Welcome to the Magic and Alchemy podcast, where we talk about witchcraft, setting intentions, forgotten folklore, and mythology. Created by Tamed Wild, Magic and Alchemy is a collection of stories, rituals, and articles crafted by a variety of creators and writers, including myself, Kristen Lisenby, and my co-host, Kate Ballou. Hello, and welcome back to the Magic and Alchemy podcast. I'm Kristen Lisenby.
And I'm Kate Ballou.
How excited are you to talk about witches and film and pop culture today, Kate?
So excited.
Same.
Yes. Yes, yes. So, Kristen, before introducing our magical guest for today's conversation, I have to ask you, who is your favorite representation of a pop culture witch?
Well, I can't say favorite witch because you're asking me what is actually an impossible question.
True.
But when I think about an impactful witch or a really memorable witch, I would say Sabrina. I think my first introduction to her was my neighbor's mother used to work at a library. And so she gave me a huge stack of old Sabrina comics, or Sabrina was in these comics. And that was so much fun. So I have this memory of reading them on the floor one summer afternoon. And then I obviously watched the 90s version of Sabrina, the Teenage Witch, growing up. So Sabrina's story is very nostalgic to me. You know, the teenage girl growing up in a house with her two witchy aunts and a talking cat. But I think it's actually the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, that version, that I prefer today, just for the more modern spin and gothic aesthetic. You know, I love 90s Sabrina and especially Salem, but it's so campy, like all 90s shows. So I love that version for the nostalgic aspect, but the updated Sabrina is just a bit edgier. And I think there was more thought put into what witchcraft looks like or what it can look like while still having some really interesting, fantastical elements woven into the story. But what do you think about this impossible question?
Yeah, I love the reframing of impactful. That's really nice. And I love the Sabrina reflections. I liked watching the new one, the aesthetic, like you said. There's just something really, really fun about that. And of course, Old Salem. I know we're going to talk a little bit more about Sabrina in the interview, but I don't know. I love so many of them. Like, so many came to mind. Witches of Eastwick came to mind. I mean, mostly because of the cast and the clothing. Yes. I mean, come on. But the Love Witch is like kind of a newer sort of aesthetic. I mean, I think that the director just does such a cool job with that movie. But I think my favorite or most impactful interpretation of the witch in pop culture would have to be a pair of witches. And I'm going to have to say Sally and Jillian Owens, like the Owens sisters of Practical Magic.
Yes.
They do no wrong, in my opinion. I love the house, the relationship with the ants themselves, the clothes, the town, the apothecary, the greenhouse, the soundtrack. I mean, come on.
Yes.
We've got that plot arc, the spells. I mean, when she brings a dustbuster as a broom over to the house and they're doing the whole sort of like circle ritual. I don't know. It's just it's just so good. And also just like the undying magic of having a sister is so special. Hello to my sister Grace. I just, two sister witches. I love it. I love it so much. Listeners, post your most impactful pop culture witches and tag us. I know Kristen and I would love to see them.
Yes, definitely. And I know we're obviously, like you said, going to ask the same question to our guest today. So would you like to introduce her?
I'd love to. Heather Green is a freelance writer, journalist, and editor. She received a BA in film at Wesleyan University and an MA in film studies from Emory University. She also studied film and theater at Cornell University and the University of Paris. She's written for Religion News Service, Turner Classic Movies, The Wild Hunt, Circle Magazine, Pathos.com, and other outlets. She currently works as an acquisitions consultant for Llewellyn Worldwide. Her first book, Bell, Book, and Camera, A Critical History of Witches in American Film and Television, was released in spring 2018. She has since revised and updated the book as of fall 2021 with the new title, Lights, Camera, Witchcraft, A Critical History of Witches in American Film and Television.
Heather joined us from her home via Zoom. Hello, and welcome back to the Magic and Alchemy podcast. I'm Kristen Lisenby.
And I'm Kate Ballou.
Heather, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about witches and movies.
Yes.
Yeah, really excited about this. And I know just a moment ago we gave your professional bio, but would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners in your own words?
Sure. I am Heather Green. I am a journalist. I'm an editor at Llewellyn Worldwide. I am also an author and a writer. I've written, some of my work has been out in various places like Religion News Service. I tend to focus on religion, the occult, witchcraft, and all things in between. And I also have written the book, Lights, Camera, Witchcraft, A Critical History of Witches in American Film and Television. So those are some of my current things I've been doing.
Amazing. And today we want to talk witchcraft, film, and pop culture witches, as well as this beautiful book that you mentioned. But to get us started, we would love to know your relationship to this word, witch.
Oh, gosh. What a difficult question, but an interesting one. I think that's one we should all constantly be asking ourselves as we grow and change as witches and occult practitioners. But I think basically I became interested in witchcraft and various forms of occult practice back in college, like many people's stories start, starting with astrology and tarot reading and expanding from there. And my interest grew, discovering Wicca, of course, and watching the movie The Craft in the 90s. And that grew over time, eventually getting involved in media work for Coven of the Goddess and expanding from there in my career. So I never expected that I would have a career around this interest I developed back then. So, you know, I've been practicing and researching and living within this world for many decades now, and I love it.
That's what we like to hear. And in the foreword of your book, more on that in just a minute, you remind us that the figure of the witch is nothing if not complex and contradictory. You write that the witch archetype exists in two modes, one of oppression and one of empowerment. As well, the witch is someone who changes and adapts to the times she inhabits. Can you expand on this for us and maybe explain a little bit about how your understanding of the archetypal witch has evolved and grown and changed over the years?
Yeah, I think this is something that I hit on in a recent presentation at Paganicon, which is a big festival for pagans and witches and mystical people every year, where I've been so curious about what it is. What is a witch? And this book and writing this book and some of the work I've done in journalism really has made me distill that archetype down to this this revolutionary, this rebel is essentially what the witch is. And I'm not just talking about in the last 10, 20, 50 years. I'm talking about in the centuries since the beginning. And I actually traced it and presented that at in, at Paganicon this year is how that term, so the witch evolves and changes, like your last question, how has it evolved and changed? She evolves and changes as she always is the rebel, but she evolves and changes depending on what she needs to rebel against. So if a witch from, 2000 years ago might have been a Jewish woman trying to just simply practice her Judaism, but she wasn't allowed to as a woman. So that would have been a form of, or someone who would have been called a witch thousands of years ago. That would not be the case today. Today, the witch is obviously people who feel the need to find a community that might not fit into the mainstream, or they might be rebelling against something else, or they might be choosing that, or maybe not choosing it in some parts of the world and being called that for negative reasons as well. So there's a lot of reasons, but there always seems to be this center point, this place of rebellion, whether it's small and personal or whether it's big and societal.
Do you remember what that rebellion was for you on your own personal journey as a witch?
You know, that's a great question that I've asked myself, because I was able to take my, you know, for a lot of people, the rebellion is simply parents or a rejection of someone's birth religion, you know, on a modern scale right now. And that wasn't the case for me in either way. I didn't rebel against my my parents' religion. And I took Buckland's Big Blue Book out right on my parents' couch and sat there, and they looked at me and they didn't care. They'd actually recently grabbed a couple of my tarot decks to look at. So the rebellion for me is, I think a rebellion against the mainstream culture I was raised in. That kind of upper middle class suburban feel didn't feel right to me. And I think I felt there was more. And I think that was my pushback. I need to sit with that for another couple decades and I might have a different answer, but right now that's, I believe, what the pushback was. I grew up outside of New York City looking at the skyline, and that for me was almost a deity. Looking at that skyline, looking at the art, knowing that there was a world out there of these other things, these other people, So I think for me, rejecting of the suburban culture that I was raised in, and finding these other things, finding that spice. That's where I've landed right now with that answer. Get back to me in a couple of years.
I love that. And I love thinking about the skyline as a deity too. I have had similar thoughts living here in New York City. It's
magical, isn't it? It's its own thing.
People are always like, I'm so surprised, like, you being so witchy or earth-based that you live in Brooklyn. And I'm like, oh no, like, if you were here, you would know what I was talking about or why, you know.
It's true. And there was a children's book that talked about it. And I can't remember the author off the top of my head right now that talked about that. And it really, sitting there reading this book to my child, I was like, oh my goodness, yes. New York City skyline. And it described the, George Washington Bridge with the lights along it as like a necklace, like a pearl necklace or a gold necklace. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. So it was like a deity. It was a calling to me.
Oh, if you think of the children's book's name later, definitely send it along.
I will do it.
I feel like you touched on this a little bit already, but there was something else you wrote in your book that I thought was so beautiful. You wrote that within fictional narratives, the witch is, at her most basic, a woman who lives in the space society has deemed to abandon. And when I read that, I immediately highlighted it. It really stood out to me. And so I'm curious, why do you think that is?
Well, I think we're talking about a couple of different things here. So, you know, I touched on the idea of this rebel and the places society has abandoned in that realm, or rejects or ignores. And to be clear, when I'm talking about the gendering here, and I always like to be clear about this, the book focuses on and lets Hollywood lead. So specifically, like in the quote you just put out there, says women and she. It's because Hollywood specifically highlights and represents witches as women for the most part. And the places that are sacred or comfortable for these witches in these films are usually places that have been abandoned. And that would be specifically woods, woodlands, the dark woods, nature. They usually linked with that. Old cabins. And other places where these liminal spaces, again, these places that people are rejected to. I loved this one author I worked with, wrote a book called Outside the Charm Circle. And when she was writing about that, she was specifically talking about the queer community. So, but I'm borrowing that concept, and I love borrowing the concept because it's perfect. It's that there is this charm circle, maybe the suburban life that I knew, for example, or this charm circle where people are easily accepted. They look right, they act right, the jobs are right, whatever's the centerpiece of our world or society. And then there's outside the charm circle, witches exist outside the charm circle, and outside are places that have been forgotten, like the woods, like the wild woods, the cabin in the woods, you know, Hansel and Gretel, I think, or just places where people are pushed because they aren't accepted. And that's where what's the world of the witch? And Hollywood leads with that. And that's the point of that phrase that I'm talking about. Hollywood actually uses that. And we see that visually speaking and narratively speaking in Hollywood film one after the other, from the new ones to the old ones and vice versa.
So to talk more about your beautiful book, in Lights, Camera, Witchcraft, A Critical History of Witches in American Film and Television, readers follow the witch through decades of American entertainment. Can you tell our listeners more about this book? Who is it for? And how did this project begin?
Well, let's see. It began in the 90s. I was in studying film. I have two film degrees, and a bachelor's and a master's. And so I was really interested in film history, you know, and all aspects of it. And I loved writing about it and thinking about it. So I was doing that work. And then alongside noticing, of course, alongside I was studying witchcraft and various forms of the occult. And then I noticed that there were a plethora of witchcraft films being released at the time. Okay. This is the 90s now. So you can imagine I saw The Craft and I saw Little Witches and I saw Charmed and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and just one after another. And I was like, something is going on. And because of the type of work I'd done, because of the type of film studies that I was focused on, which was politically and driven by society and politics and religion, I knew something was going on. I knew there had to be links. And I also knew that the Wicca and witchcraft were becoming increasingly popular. So at the time, I thought this would be a great study. I didn't do it then. Life got in the way. And I wound up doing my final master's thesis on Disney and not on the witches. And then moved to other things, and time went by, and finally decided, okay, wait a minute, I'm going to do this because I really want to. And I'm glad I waited, actually, because if I had done it in the 90s, there would have been a lot of data and a lot of movies missed, and I wouldn't have had the strength, the strength of facts, and been able to watch other things going on to really have a solid understanding about what Hollywood was doing currently, what was happening currently, instead of having three cycles of witch film popularity. I would have had only two. And I really would not have understood it in the late 90s the way I can understand it now. So, and I'll probably, I could, if I do it 20 years from now, I would say the same thing. I should have waited. I think this was good. the book can get updated in 20 years.
Part two.
Yeah. So that's how it started. And I spent four or five years watching movies, rewatching movies, writing, researching, and all of that. And here's what I have.
I mean, it definitely shows that you spent so much time on this book. Kate and I were talking when we first got this book, that the bibliography and the tome of movies listed in this book is just so impressive. And I'm definitely partial to the section that's dedicated to 90s witches, but in your book, you talk about witches and witchy moments that appear in The Simpsons, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, Practical Magic, Hocus Pocus, the witch Hazel from Looney Tunes, who I was so, so excited to see in there. You also talk about The Craft, The Love Witch, Betty Boop is in there, The Dark Crystal. I feel like I could go on and on. There are so many. But I have to ask, do you have a favorite witch from pop culture or a magical movie that you think doesn't get enough credit?
I have one that I think is worth witches watching. It's not as beloved as most of the films that you just talked about, or most of the characters. In fact, it's very not known at all for the most part. And that's a movie called Season of the Witch. Also, it was called Hungry Wives when it was first released. It's a 1970s film. It has a very strong feminist undertone and really captures the idea of why a lot of people turn to witchcraft. And some of the things we were just talking about, in fact, It's a great film. It's underrated. It was low budget. And I love pointing it out. When people watch it, they're a little bit, I don't know what to say. Some people can't watch it because it is a 1970s B film, but it's a great movie. I also like to point out The Last Keepers, which is a 2013 film. And it's also not one that seems to be known very well in the witchcraft community, but it has the spirit of modern witchcraft and Wicca specifically that a lot of the films don't have. When people ask me what's a film that really represents witchcraft well, and I like to point to The Last Keepers because it's such a beautiful little movie. It's a typical high school rom-com type story, you know, witchy girl meets, you know, normie boy, and they fall in love, and, you know, but it's got Olympia Dukakis, and it's a lovely take on art and teenage years and magic and witchcraft. So I like to point that one out too. Those are two that I, off the top of my head, I can think of.
And then credit or no credit, do you have a favorite all-time depiction of the witch?
I always say the Wicked Witch of the West, because I love The Wizard of Oz, and I have since I was a child. I'm a big fan of movie musicals and musicals in general. So, you know, you have old movie, you have witches, you have music. I mean, what's not to love, you know? Oh, so
it's perfect.
I love it. And I actually talk about it right at the beginning that The Wicked Witch is probably my all-time favorite witch. Now, I do have fascinations with other witches, and I do have ones. I love the witch in Pumpkinhead, which always surprises people because Pumpkinhead is a horror movie from late 1980s. I love that movie. You know, if I was to say one, my favorite Hollywood witch, it would have to be the Wicked Witch of the West. MGM's version, the classic, Margaret Hamilton.
We talked about Margaret Hamilton going on... Mr. Rogers' show, and just how tender that moment is and that depiction. I love that. I love her.
Yeah. And what's fascinating is that created such a buzz in the 1980s when the Satanic Panic hit. When they aired it in the 70s, it had no effect. But when it aired again during the Satanic Panic, parents complained. It was very interesting.
Oh, Yeah. I didn't think about that. That makes, interesting.
Yeah. How dare you suggest, you know, how dare you have witches on the show? So, yeah. Very interesting.
Do you have a least favorite Hollywood witch? Like one that just like grinds you?
Oh, goodness. One that grinds
you. You don't have to answer.
Julio, if you want to give me a minute, I can come up with an answer.
Like, no pressure.
I feel pressure. No.
That's such a good question, though. I've never really thought about that before. I'm just always talking about how much I love them, you know? I'm
trying to think if there's one that, like, grinds me. Sometimes Sabrina grinds me.
Which one? 90s or the recent one?
90s, but at the same time, I love her, so it's confusing to me. But there's something about her sometimes where I'm like, what?
It's all about Salem, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think it's the characters. I mean, I'm sure I have one that would bother me, and I just can't think of it at the moment. So you'll have to give me a couple weeks and I'll email you. But
perfect.
But I think the narratives bother me more, or the witch movies I don't like are typically ones that are the movies themselves are just not good, or the narrative is so off base. But I'm very forgiving when it comes to movies. So generally speaking, I don't really, I can't think of something. I'm not a big fan of Hocus Pocus. The original one, I have said that. And I was, I am part of the book that's coming out, and I'm talking about Hocus Pocus because it is a very important movie in witchcraft movies. And it is a very popular movie. And the second one was better done than the first one in my mind. But I don't hate the witches. And that's the argument I always have when I discuss Hocus Pocus and my dislike for it. It wasn't the witches that were the problem for me. They're fun. Mm. And they're the best part of it. And that's why the second movie focuses on them. And that's why the second movie is better. So, but yeah, I can't think of any characters, but I'm sure there is. Like I said, give me some time, give me a week or two, and it'll pop into my head. Or maybe overnight at 3 a.m.
Yeah. We're gonna wake up to an email.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Kristen, do you have one?
I'm honestly trying to think. I mean, I will agree with you that the 90s Sabrina, like, I mean, I grew up watching that, you know, it was wonderful, but she's very campy, you know, so there is something that maybe can kind of like irk you a little bit. But yeah, I'm just there for the Salem because he's the draw for me.
Yeah,
he's a great character.
He is.
He really is.
But yeah, your book, you talk quite a bit about Wizard of Oz. So I just have to say, if we have any Wizard of Oz listeners out there, this book has so many great conversations, even beyond the witch.
I went on a Wizard of Oz podcast on a witch segment. They interviewed me about New York City witches. And so for folks who are fans, definitely check out Tara's podcast, because I'm blanking on the full name of it right now, but DM me and I'll send it to you, because there's so much interesting Wizard of Oz lore.
Mm-hmm. There is. And I'm very excited and to be part of Charl Oz, which is going to be happening in September, which is a Wizard of Oz convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I'll be speaking about the witches in film and television and in the way they progress, because the Wizard of Oz is single-handedly the most influential witch movie across. The only thing more influential on witch narratives in Hollywood would be Macbeth. But that's not a movie, not so much the Wizard of Oz original books, although that's how it started. The actual movie from MGM is those two witches are the most influential witches, specifically the Wicked Witch, in all of Hollywood's history. And that's why they appear so much in my book, because everybody just kept wanting to remake them and again and again and again. So yeah.
Ooh, thoughts on Wicked coming out this year?
I am so excited.
Me too.
I have seen the musical, and I know all the songs, and I'm so excited.
You're ready.
Cautiously excited, because I don't want it to be ruined, but I am excited.
Yeah. From the press tour with the outfits already, it's like...
Unbelievable.
A dream.
Yes. Agreed. I'm so far very excited. I will probably be first in line to buy a ticket and front and center. And they are going to have to hold me back to not sing during the...
Maybe they'll offer sing-along versions because that would be fun.
I hope so. I hope so.
You also mention a fun fact slash rumor from the set of Practical Magic that I would love to share. So you write, Practical Magic was largely unsuccessful, although it has since gained a cult following for its upbeat and open expression of witchcraft. Anecdotally, Dunn, the film director, was convinced that the film's failure was due to a curse placed on production by a witch consultant. The consultant reportedly wanted a percentage of the film's profits rather than a consulting fee, and the producers would not agree. In an interview, Dunn claims the witch told the producers, "I'm going to put a curse on you. I'm putting a curse on this movie." And then later, in another phone call, the woman slipped into tongues. Dunn said he was frightened, and the lawyers eventually paid her off, and she was off the production. Whether or not this account is correct is not clear. However, Dunn maintains the film was cursed. I thought this was such an interesting story. I've never heard this before. But it just got me wondering, in all the research you did for this book, like, were cursed films or haunted sets common occurrences or happenings?
Not really, actually. This was an anecdotal story. Whether it actually happened, I've never been able to prove either way. It's just the director's retelling of it. I don't think the movie is as cursed as he might have believe it was. Actually, it's extremely popular, at least in the witchcraft community.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. See, yes. It's done quite well within the witchcraft community, often named as their people's favorites, and the best depiction of witchcraft. The one film that I can think about that actually did have cursing or was thought of to be cursed in some way was Rosemary's Baby, and that came out in 1968. It was popular and came out during a time when The Church of Satan was very popular in Hollywood. Witchcraft books were first coming on the scene, and a lot of people in Hollywood were reading them. So there was this real sense of witchcraft and spell work in Hollywood at the time. And so there was a relationship. There was a connection between Rosemary's Baby, which is obviously about a satanic coven, and a possible cursing of the film. And not by any particular person, but just it was considered cursed because a lot of bad things happen to people involved in the film or connected to the film. And the most notable one was the death of Sharon Tate, which was the director Polanski's wife. And obviously if you don't know, she was killed by Charles Manson's group. So you have the connection to Charles Manson murders, Sharon Tate. I believe there was several other crew members who had career failures after, like big career failures, and just a string of other negative things that were connected to it. And that has led people to believe that that film was cursed. Now, I don't really think it's all that cursed, considering it's one of the best witchcraft films out there and is still watched today over and over. But yes, that is the one. Now, I think what's interesting to talk about just in relationship to this is that I had an interview with several witch consultants, which are now more common than they were back then. That she talked about actually being on the set and doing rituals at the start and end of filming. So that way, nothing did get cursed. And her point was that when the universe, the magics, the powers that be don't know whether someone's an actor doing a spell or a witch doing a spell. So an actor could do a spell in a scene and conjure something or evoke something that they don't want. So the witch is on the set making sure everything goes well in terms of magic and spirit, etc. So I thought that was an interesting comment that she made when I was talking to her. And it would do Hollywood well if they considered that going forward to avoid cursed films.
Yeah. I think I read an interview with someone talking about The Craft, like the older one, and for The Binding Spell, like they changed like just a couple things, but the rest of it was all kind of correct. Is that a true thing, or am I making that up?
Yeah. The Craft had a consultant on it. She was a high priestess, Wiccan, part of Coven of the Goddess. That was in 96. She was one of the first more prominent ones. So there was some reality involved. Of course, Hollywood does what Hollywood's going to do with it to make it into a story and to make it into a fictional film. So there was some reality to it. And the practitioner, and I'm sorry, the actresses, at least two of them are actual practitioners or were. Rachel True has had a tarot deck out. She's a reader, is very outspoken when it comes to her work in magic and divination. And I believe there is at least one or two others that also were somewhat connected to the craft.
Firuza Balk, I think, has a
shop.
And maybe a Patreon, too. I think I've seen that. Like, there's some sort of community there that she's built.
Yes, I believe she is the other one that had a connection, too. How much they were practicing, I know I've read Rachel True's book, so I know that she was already involved before the craft was filmed. I don't know about Firuza Balk, but how much they contributed to that reality and how much the high priestess, the Wiccan high priestess did, you know, I don't know for sure. But they were there. Reality was there. Some reality.
So interesting. It's such a cool job.
I know, right? And it's becoming more, increasing more and more when you see witch films, that they do have somebody who is involved to some degree on set, consulting with the script, consulting with on set, like I said, or consulting with the script or consulting with the costuming or whatever.
So I know we're talking a lot about 90s witches and 90s films, but this book is truly a tome. So could you speak a little bit about how this book is structured, how it's laid out, and then maybe even how many years this book spans?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the last question first. It begins at the beginning of Hollywood, which is... technically, I mark it as 1896, but really the first witch film is not until the early 1900s. Maybe it's a little bit earlier than that. But anyway, I began looking at films in 1896 with the beginning of what would become Hollywood. And then it goes period by period, not exactly decade by decade, but just period by period through until 2020. And the different periods are broken up, usually marked by changes in the way witches are being represented, or a technological change like the introduction of color and sound, or by socio-political changes, the coming of television, the civil rights movement, or industry changes like the ending of the production code and the beginning of the rating system. So there's a lot of reasons I have things broken up, all of which are impactful on the representation of witches and witchcraft. So I go through again, I go through the early 1900s, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, chapter by chapter. And at the end of each chapter, there is a list, a filmography of all of the films that I speak about within that chapter, as well as a few extras that maybe didn't make it the cut into the longer discussion, but are important to look at. And yes, I've seen every film that is listed in this book at least once.
So cool.
Some I regrettably saw because they're not all, because keep in mind, you got to watch the bad ones to know what the good ones are, right? So as an old film professor once wisely said, so I have seen them all. And I talk about as many as I can, grouping them together, telling you why they're important. And I always like to tell people, don't read this book straight through. Read a chapter, watch a movie when I'm talking about it. It'll make it so much more fun. Because watching the movies is why we're reading this book. That's the whole point, is seeing how witches and witchcraft has evolved over time, why we love these films, when do we see witchcraft we actually might know? You'll actually see some in the 70s films. That's why those are actually fun to watch. So it's really, it's for me, this is as much fun as it is informative.
Listeners, get your film clubs, your groups ready for Season of the Witch this fall. Oh my gosh, I watched Carrie with a group of girlfriends this year for the first time, and I had never seen it, and it was so much fun. Gosh. It was so much fun.
That's probably one of the best witchcraft films. And it's only tangentially a witchcraft film, really. They only use the word witch once or twice, but it's considered one, so I kept it in there. And it's probably one of the best American-made American films, period. But yeah, such a good one.
I was happy to see it in the book because I was like, oh, yeah. So, and the set is so cool. All the
the filmmaking is excellent. I do have to say is that I always get caught on why isn't this film in there? Why isn't this 99% of the films are in there? But yes, there are some that I go, ooh, I missed one. So if there's ones that, you know, if your listeners find one that I have missed, please reach out to me and I will watch it and I will put it on the list of which missed films.
I was super intrigued by the intersection of the Westerns and witch movies. Like, that's something I've never seen or thought about. And I think that I'm going to take my research journey there because I'm so curious to watch those.
Yeah, that's from the TV shows. Mostly from the 50s. I was very surprised. It's a very interesting little period of time of representation of witchcraft where they just start appearing in these Western films in the conservative 1950s. Very interesting. Yes.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. She goes through all kinds of genres. She's not only in horror and fantasy, which is what people just assume, but nope. She appears in comedy, pure comedy films. She appears in rom-coms. She appears in old black and white films and melodramas and obviously in Westerns. There's a number of them, too. Just everything.
Hey, witches. Shelby here, and I'm the creatrix behind Tamed Wild. I wanted to pop in here real quick to let you know about my podcast, The Moon in Carolina. On this one-woman show, I share experiences and insight related to personal growth, life challenges, manifesting, and leaning into spirituality. My top three episodes so far have been Bankruptcy, Borrowing, and Talking to the Universe, where I shared my story of financial ruin and how I climbed out, Breaking Up with Jesus, my journey from a Southern Baptist to a practicing pagan, and Astrology for Manifesting, where I share how personifying the planets has helped me understand their energies in my life and in my chart. If you're looking for a new podcast to add to your library, I hope you'll give mine a try. Now, back to the lovely Kristen and Kate and this episode of Magic and Alchemy.
So we would love to shift gears a little bit. And can you talk, Heather, a little bit about being an acquisitions consultant for Llewellyn? I know that so many of our listeners love this press, as Kristen and I do. Tamed Wild carries a lot of titles from there. So how did you get started in this work, and how does it influence your own practice and your writing?
I got started sort of an evolution of my career, being in and around the pagan and witchcraft communities as a writer and an editor. They had an opening, and I was able to come on board, and I absolutely have loved the work. I've been there since 2018 now, working with just wonderful authors on so many different topics, and that's how it affects my work how it affects me personally. Is not only do I get to interact with some wonderful people, some talented people, which is always part of the witchcraft community I've always loved, is being able to talk to other people that are in this world. Somewhere under the umbrella of magic and witchcraft. And the other way is that I get to read all of their books. I take a step into their world, into their witching world. I get to learn It's like I get a, you know, a college degree constantly, you know, take a college class. And I get to also help people realize their dreams, which is partly something I've been doing for a lot of years in different capacities, is helping people achieve, helping people step into the sunlight and shine. I love doing that for people if I can, giving them the microphone to talk, as you guys do on this podcast. So I love all of that. It helps, reading the reading about different types of ways witchcraft is practiced, either traditional Wicca or brujeria or traditional Wicca, all of these things, they help my practice, keep it real, and, you know, test me, make me think. I love that. And, you know, again, meeting different people, and it's just overall a wonderful, immersive job.
And Kristen and I call it the Witch Wide Web.
The Witch Wide Web, yes.
one of the perks of the job.
Yes, yes. I mean, who would have thought, like, you know, years ago when I was starting to read tarot cards and witchcraft was something I did in my dorm room and nobody knew about, would become, you know, my whole world. You know, I could make a career out of being part of this community. It's a dream come true in many ways, and I love it. So, no downside.
Heather, I'm curious, how do you see the overlaps of magic and the creative process or the writing process?
I think there's a definite overlap, because I think creativity and the creative output comes from a place, similar place where magic comes from. I think there's magic in creativity because it's similar to manifestation. But I don't want to use the word magic so much as I want to use spirit and spiritual, because there's a lot of people who don't practice magic who also create beautiful things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the creativity and the ability to create anything comes from this special deep place. And I think it's the same place that magic comes from, magical intention. But I think that place is defined by our spirit and our soul. And so, like I said, I think that's the connection. So I think for witches, for people who do practice magic, I think it is advantageous to tap into that place through magic and using magical tools before creating, whether it's, you know, a simple meditation or getting into the zone, as some people call it, however, a candle and an incense, whatever it is for you. But I think using your magical skills and using that place to get to that center, to find that spirit, it only enhances the creative process. So that's would be the connection for me.
I definitely think creating anything is a spiritual process. Mm-hmm. Like if you really sit down and think about it, I agree with you that I think using spirit is maybe a better word in this scenario, because it really does touch something that is sort of without words, mm-hmm. or that cannot be described.
Yeah, I think spirit and soul are the only ways, but there's a center place to all of us that, like you said, can't be named. And that magic allows us to get to that place. And then once magic had ignited even, and then pour forth the creativity, you know, that whether the creativity is simply being your authentic self or whether it is painting or writing, whatever that is, if it comes from that place, it's true. And you can see that. That's why, you know, I think that AI art is and AI creative stuff is without a soul, as someone said to me recently.
Yes, yes.
It is.
So I think, yeah, that's the connection. I think it's important.
I'm sort of curious. I don't want to go on off a tangent here because I know we don't have a ton of time left, but I'm also just curious, you know, working in acquisitions, how you've seen AI influence the publishing world, or have you?
I think it depends on the publishing house, but we don't work with AI. So I haven't seen it, which is a wonderful thing.
Yes.
But I can't. Yeah, I love, you know, with all the faults that human beings do in their writing and in their art and all of the little intricacies, that's part of that soul. So yeah. I haven't personally seen it. I don't know what other publishing houses are doing and what they're saying, but I haven't personally seen it, and I hope that continues.
I saw somewhere online, it was like, I don't want AI to make my art. I want AI to like do my taxes and like fold my laundry yes. so that I can do my art. And I was like, yes, that is it for me too.
Absolutely. I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. It's a tool, and let it be only a tool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have so many word witches who listen to Magic and Alchemy, Heather. So do you have any behind the scenes secrets you can share from the publishing world? Something maybe you wish more writers knew when it comes to getting their work out in the world?
Behind the scenes, I think the advice that I like to give to writers when they're starting out, with especially with their first book, is don't overthink. And when I say that, I mean, the analogy I use is a sandbox. You want to have this beautiful castle in your sandbox that's perfect in all ways and all the things and whatever toys and color and all these things. But when you just have a sandbox and a bunch of sand, the first thing you need to do is get the sand in the sandbox. So throw it all in there, gather all the stuff, throw it in there, throw your sand in the sandbox, just start piling it up. Don't worry about the finer things. Just get it out. So what I mean is get it all out there. Write your book, get it all out there. Put more in than you think needs to be in there. Then after you're done, you start the editing, because you can't edit what's not there. And you don't know, because a book, really, especially a book, and although I will say this happens for articles when I do journalism as well, for shorter pieces, is a book is not something you go, this is what it's going to be when it's over, so I'm going to write that. And if you do that, you'll get stuck. So you say, this is sort of the concept. Get to my zone, get to my place, and just start putting down all the stuff. And as you let that creativity flow, as you put that sand in that sandbox, you'll start to see it take form, and it's organic, and it might go in a different direction than you actually thought it would be. And if you do it that way, it'll be much more organic. It'll feel much better. It'll feel powerful. And then you find out in the end what exactly you were doing. Then in the end, as you're editing it, you will see what it's becoming. And then you'll be able to put your little nuances and your little, you know, your extras. You put your little shells where you want them, and you do all that in the end. It's like, that's why a lot of writers will tell you, editors will tell you, always write your first chapter, intro chapter, or your first paragraph of your article. Always do it last, because you don't know the way the book is going to go. And you could think it's going in left and it goes right. So that's
so true.
So that's the creative thing. Yeah. So that's the creative process that I would recommend. I've had so many authors who have gotten delayed and stuck trying to think about, I'm trying to do this, and holding on so tight, worrying about it, getting so wrapped up in that. And I just like, oh, just write whatever, just write, get the information out there. I usually personally will write a really terrible first paragraph to my article, to my articles, and knowing that it's going to be terrible. Then I write the whole thing. Then I go back and rewrite the introduction, the first paragraph, once I know exactly where I landed. So that's not insider industry information, but that's insider writer information for the would-be author, and if you have any of them listening.
It's beautiful advice. Mm-hmm.
Good. I and your editors will back you, and really good writing comes in writing, great writing comes in editing. So relax, just let it flow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, embrace the ugly first draft. You know, they're always ugly.
Always.
And that's totally fine. It's part of the process.
Yeah, typos, they live in first drafts. They love it there. Mm-hmm. They thrive. Let them thrive for a while. My first draft of the Lights, Camera, Witchcraft, I was writing, I kept saying that Glinda was the bad witch. I had it in like three places. Mm. It was a typo, clearly, because I know, but it was a typo. And I laughed so hard when I finally saw that from my production editor. She was like, did you mean this? I'm like, oh my goodness, what was going on? Where was I when I wrote that? It's probably like 3 o'clock in the morning after putting kids to sleep and I wasn't thinking. It happens to all of us.
So I'm so sad, Heather, because I think we're running out of time. And I know that Kristen and I could talk film and witches and writing with you just all day. But before we go, we'd love to ask, what's next for you, or what are you currently excited about and looking forward to?
Well, next for me is more or less the same. I'm continuing to work with my authors, and that brings new books and new projects constantly, which I love. So, you know, I have 50 plus projects in some form of finished at this point. And I love that aspect of my job. So there's going to be lots of new ones coming up. I also continue to write, do journalistic work, and I don't know what stories those are going to bring. So I'll continue to do that. I am looking forward to, I'm on the board for Mystic South, and I'm looking forward to that, which comes in April. Sorry, we're in April right now. It comes in July. And that is a pagan witchcraft event that happens here in Atlanta, and I'm doing a workshop there on dolls and haunted dolls and puppets, which is one of my hobbies. Ooh. And I love that topic. So I'm presenting on it for the first time at Mystic South in Atlanta. And I also continue to appear on the Witches Movie Coven every Wednesday. It's a podcast where we talk about movies every week. This week, it's going to be Little Witches from the 90s. And we do that every week. So we continue to have fun at that. So those are the things that, and I said Charlotte also is coming up. So those are the things for now. And I'm going to keep on doing those things until I decide when it's time to write another book, which, of course, once a writer, always a writer. So it'll happen at some point as soon as I can find the time.
Do you have any last words of wisdom to share with our listeners, Heather? And where can our listeners find your work?
Sure. I think words of wisdom I already gave to the would-be authors. And I think to the witches out there, just keep being beautiful and keep being witchy. That's what our world needs right now. More of us. So I would say, keep doing that, be authentic, read lots of books, and find your soul. So, where can you find me? I'm on all of the socials, normal ones, usually Heather Green or Heather Green Writes. I am at heathergreen.net. Not heathergreen.com, heathergreen.net. Heathergreen.com is for a whiskey expert. So another very good W word, but it's not me. I am heathergreen.net, and all of my socials are linked there. And usually I will put articles up there. Typically my articles are published at Religion News Service or Religion Unplugged. So you can find them there. And I think that's pretty much it. And my authors are at Llewellyn.com, so you can go find all of my great authors, their books there. And the list of ones that I've worked on is on my Facebook page. It isn't public. I have a bookshelf where you can see all the books I've worked on.
Thank you so much, Heather, and listeners, for joining us today on Magic and Alchemy, a podcast from Tamed Wild. Again, we're Kate Ballou and Kristen Lisenby. You can find us online at K8Ballou and at East and Alchemy. Send us your questions and comments, or just say hello via email at podcast@tamedwild.com. You can view all the amazing offerings from Tamed Wild on their Instagram at Tamed Wild or on the blog tamedwild.com.
Join us back here in 2 weeks for another magical conversation. Just a reminder that magic and alchemy are always available to those who know where to look for it. So mote it be, or something better. Until next time.